Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. So, Noreen, how was your week?
My week was fine. Unremarkable in the fact that I wasn't feeling terribly sick.
Great.
And yet that's quite remarkable.
Yeah. Remarkable for being unremarkable.
Yeah. Although I do seem to have got a thing with my memory at the moment, whereas I forgot my anniversary and I forgot your birthday. That just could be just the sheer volume of stuff I've got to do at the moment.
Yeah, but it's interesting because you've always said that you don't really have brain fog, but in your former life, would you have had problems with your memory? Some people are like that.
I wasn't generally like that. No, it was out of the ordinary. On my anniversary, I completely forgot. 100%.
Zero. I remembered your anniversary.
Zero recognition that my anniversary was coming up. I was wondering why my husband was flying in. I was like, why are you making such an effort? And it still didn't click.
That's hilarious. Anyway. How's your heart feeling?
My heart's not too bad. I'm trying a few things. I'm trying to exercise a bit because my blood pressure seems to be steadily rising over the last 3 years, as is my resting heart rate. And I'm trying, while I'm not feeling awful, to bring it down naturally rather than use drugs.
Yeah, and that's not some sort of graded exercise therapy. That's just listening to your body and working your way up as you feel appropriate.
I think graded exercise therapy is so, it's not even the word misunderstood. I think you shouldn't exercise if you feel shit. If you feel okay, maybe do a bit of exercise.
Just to
That's
clarify,
my philosophy.
We're not doctors, but I think this is very sage advice from Noreen. If you feel a bit shit, don't do it.
Exactly. Like, I couldn't exercise at all when my tachycardia was out of control and I couldn't breathe going upstairs. But now I can breathe going upstairs, I can do a bit of exercise. That yep. can't be a bad thing.
So you use those things as your markers. And I think that we've learned so much more about listening to our bodies and being in tune with our bodies over the past years.
I'm still a bit confused about pacing because I don't think I suffer with PEM because I've never really had that kind of crushing tiredness. But I definitely couldn't exercise because, you know, I couldn't breathe because I was breathless.
And you do tend to go into crashes after periods where you've exerted yourself quite heavily, not necessarily in terms of exercise, but when you've been running around a lot and you know you've slightly been overdoing it, you do have a tendency to feel crapper. So perhaps it's just this term PEM, which feels like it should relate to just going to the gym, going for a run. I always think that my PEM is much worse from cognitive overload and mental stress. I don't ever see a direct correlation with the very specific physical exercise into PEM.
Yeah, I would say that's right, except that I don't even think that that's what I get. I think I get crashes when I get a bug, any bug, even a slight thing that my kids have brought home or that I've picked up at the shops or...
Yeah.
The moment I can feel like I've got something that my body's fighting, that's when I will crash. And that generally coincides when I'm running around a lot because I'm very busy and my immune system's obviously a bit lower and picking up stuff, you know?
Exactly. So running around a lot, being in contact with other people and that lowering of your immune defences by being somehow kind of overexposed in that way.
Yeah, I know it runs counter to a lot of stuff that we've learned over the last 3 years. But that's just how I feel my body works.
Well, I think a lot of what a lot of people go through runs counter to what anyone else is going through. And that is one of the big problems with it, isn't it? Is that the patterns do not necessarily fit.
So my week was not too shit. Actually, fairly good. And I really don't count on being healthy, or this is me being healthy because I had 3 months of really good health last summer and then I had a massive crash for 6 months. So I'm just enjoying it, except the difference is this time I've had a dose of Paxlovid, so let's see.
Yeah, when you last had COVID.
How about you, my darling? How was your week?
Since we last spoke, I went to a Grieve Armada gig and I can't drink alcohol, allergic to it. So I left the house for 4 hours basically and went and listened to music and maybe slightly shook my hips. And I was then pretty much unable to get out of bed for 4 days. I had the most horrendous migraine. The tinnitus was just off the chart. It was like having been next to the bass speaker in a club for 5 hours. This was an outdoor event. It was that horrible hit on my autonomic nervous system, I guess. And I felt really, really awful. You know, when I go into those phases, I was vomiting and I was finding it really, really hard to eat. My stomach was destroyed. Everything was a mess. So that wasn't great, to the extent that I'd cancelled all my plans for this weekend. But I have just had 5 days of not taking painkillers, 5 days of relative normalcy, I would say. I've done my yoga every day. I've been out walking every day. I've eaten every day. I know that sounds silly, but you know that I go into this just eating dry crackers, basically. But I've eaten a good diet. So I'm feeling good. Could I tell you that it was down to any one thing? No. But I seem to have rallied. Maybe it's just the sunshine. This time of year, we're normally okay, aren't we?
Yes, and I can look back because I wear a wearable, that I can see my activity levels almost double, if not slightly higher, in the summer months. I mean, most people do that anyway, but when you're sick, it's so much more noticeable.
Yeah.
But vitamin D, maybe that's the answer. Lots of it. Although when I take vitamin D, it makes no difference. Medically, for me, I saw an immunologist and they suggested that I was deficient in some area of my T cell subset somewhere, that I try taking a Pneumovax 23 vaccine and then have another blood test in 6 weeks and see if that helps things. So I will definitely let people know what happens.
Is the theory behind that that it kicks your immune system to produce more T cells, or what's the theory behind it?
Yeah, basically. I was really hesitant. I told you I was very hesitant about doing it because the last COVID vaccine did put me into quite a severe crash.
Mm.
Until they come up with a new vaccine that has changed slightly, I'll take my chances. I've had three. So I was hesitant about this, but this doesn't have, obviously, the spike protein because it's not against COVID. So then it took me a week to work up the courage, and I've had it, and I've had it last Friday.
And you haven't felt crappy yet?
Yeah, and it's 4 or 5 days post, and I haven't felt crappy.
Yeah, interested to hear what happens. I sometimes when we have conversations like this and we're both feeling good, then I feel that we're going to have some kind of backlash because people are saying, well, you're not that sick, so you're not in a position to talk about this. And we are always, always saying that we are grateful for the level at which we can operate. And we are very, very aware that there are a lot of people who are in far worse situations than us. But I did just want to say to you that I have really had a lot of gratitude in this past week. One, as you said, for the good days. Like, I really, really am grateful nowadays for the good days. But also, this having long COVID is rubbish. But there are some amazing things that have come out of it, like our relationship, the podcast, and then the people that we have met along the way. I'm honestly honoured to speak to some of these people. The humility with which a lot of people are approaching this and the lengths that people are going to try and get us better, I think it's quite remarkable. We spoke to Jim Jackson a few weeks ago, and then this week we spoke to his colleague, Wes Ely, at the SIB Centre at Vanderbilt University. And it's another person that just seems to be going out of his way, above and beyond, to try and show some kind of humanity for long COVID patients.
100%. And I tell you what, he had so much energy. He was a walking encyclopedia on long COVID and with just this massive curiosity about what was going on with people with long COVID.
I mean, that's the thing. The curiosity that these people have and the number of papers that they are going through, absorbing and using to try and further the research is remarkable.
What did Jack Lambert say? It's not rocket science.
Just do a PubMed search. And yet there are so many people that aren't doing that. And I appreciate that it's massively time consuming. But when you meet these people that have done that, it's amazing. It's amazing how much information they're absorbing and trying to disseminate. One of the things that you've done is you've taken your expertise and you're really trying to push and advocate for long COVID patients.
That's exactly right. I'm an internal medicine, pulmonary and critical care doctor who has found himself somehow repurposed into a long COVID doctor. And it's my privilege to do that. I know there's such an immense amount of suffering, and I'm so, so sorry for the amount of suffering that people are going through. So we're trying to use our center, which has been here for 20 years, to try and find answers, scientific answers, and also to build a community for long COVID sufferers to learn from each other, to share with one another, to cry, to scream, to get angry. And that's a free community. We don't charge anything for our support groups, et cetera. We also have, of course, two different types of long COVID clinics that people go to either in person or virtually. And we are right now having submitted some grants for long COVID research. I'll show you, got one sitting right here. This is a huge 470 page long COVID grant to the National Institute of Health that I've written and which is being reviewed this summer, which would hopefully be, if the NIH buys into this, be a very large randomized controlled trial to find therapeutic answers for people suffering long COVID.
You are heavily criticizing the government for not really allocating the billions that they had suggested would go towards long COVID. And this here, this submission is to try and right that a little, is it?
Yes, it's very frustrating to hear and to listen to the people who have long COVID and have them describe the misery of their life, the harrowing circumstances of their life. And I don't take that lightly. And as an insider in academics and medicine, who's at the bedside with my patients, but also somebody who does research, federally funded research, I do not take this lightly. And I feel complicit. I feel guilty and shameful that we have not provided more answers. And when the government assigns $1 billion to do research and we have no therapeutics and essentially no adequately completed, robust, randomized trials, I think that the medical community has failed the long COVID community, and I'm part of it. So I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm pointing fingers at myself. And I want us to work to fix this problem. Would it be okay with you if I gave the background? Because I think it'll connect in for your audience to understand why we were kind of essentially ready to start this work.
Yes, absolutely.
So when I started as an ICU doctor, seeing patients back in my clinic, well, I set up a clinic to see these patients. This is 25 years ago, 30 years ago. What I realized was that they had undergone some rapid acquisition within, instead of years of a dementia acquisition, they'd undergone it in 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks. And I had no idea what to do with that. It had not been described. I didn't know what to call it. And these people were suffering so much. And it turned out that 20 years later, we would come up with a term called post-intensive care syndrome, PICS. Mm-hmm. So for the next 20 years, we created this research group to try and find these people answers to improve ICU care so they wouldn't get such bad picks and also to help them in their recovery. And so we were already completely equipped to do this work, to measure neuropsychological outcomes, to implement interventional trials and do, you know, federally funded research. And then at the beginning of COVID, I made another mistake. I mean, I've made so many mistakes as a doctor, which was that when the patients were complaining of their problems after COVID, I thought this is just PICS. You know, I've been seeing this for 20 years. These are ICU patients that are graduating with post-intensive care syndrome. But then something interesting happened. I started meeting patients who had never been hospitalized, who'd only had mild COVID, and they had the same complaints of cognitive problems and massive fatigue and cardiovascular issues, which is POTS, and all the autonomic dysfunction. So I realized, oh my gosh, Wes, you're totally wrong. This is not PICS. This is a unique entity that is present in people who even have just mild viral illness during COVID. So that was when I realized at the SIB Center, we've got to help the PICS patients and the long COVID patients. Let's repurpose ourselves and do all of this.
How did you get hold of the mild long COVID patients? They didn't come through the SIB Center, did they? Were they just referred to you through your normal clinics?
They started contacting us. They came to us. It was, I think, fortuitous. I consider it a blessing in a sense that I was able to find this connection with them. During COVID, I probably wrote 7 Washington Post op-eds, Stat News, The Daily Beast, Boston Globe. So I write a lot. I wrote this book called Every Deep Drawn Breath. Every penny from this book goes back to long COVID patients and survivors, their families. So I wrote this book about people and families and suffering. It's a book that every person in there is a real person. I recorded their stories with this device. I have all their transcribed stories right here. And then they became the main characters in this narrative nonfiction book. And between that, Every Deep Drawn Breath, and the op-eds, my inbox was just filled up with long COVID patients. And when we saw the need, so Jim and I and our team, we have about 120 people in the SIB Center, and we just started saying, this is our calling. This is what we're supposed to do. We have to help with this.
What proportion of the SIB Center is now then taken up? That's a huge center, but what proportion of your time is now taken up with long COVID rather than post-ICU? Because you obviously still need to be taking care of the PICS patients. But has the long COVID taken over?
It's probably a 50-50 split. So we have these huge number of people. We have two major situations. We have the clinical core and the long-term outcome group. And the clinical core sees people acutely when they're sick in the ICU, in the hospital, or in a long COVID clinic or whatever. And then we have the long-term outcomes, the LTO group. And that's when we have people at phones out here and all in our center, which you can't see outside my office, and then in person. And we do neuropsychological batteries, physical batteries. We measure how they're doing. And that's a research operation where we have millions of dollars from the National Institute of Health, the VA, to study how are they suffering, quantify how they're suffering, and then also offer interventions to help them get their cognition back or to help them go through recovery so they can find their new normal and have it be as optimum as possible.
So I think you might have just slightly answered my next question. If you now have 50% of your patients are long COVID patients, that means that you have essentially doubled the number of patients that you are seeing.
Yeah.
Have you therefore received additional funding for your center, or do you have to apply for grants each time you need to expand?
It's the latter. We have to go create the means by which to do this work, and also blood, sweat, and tears. So we had to hire lots of new people to be present for the long COVID population that we didn't even have before. We've not reduced our ICU situation at all. So it's just as big as it ever was. And now we had to go get new grants to try and fund these people we had to hire to do this new work. I'll give you an example. I have, in academics, you can sometimes get what's called an endowed chair, where somebody provides money for an endowment that allows me to have some spending that I can use to figure out new ways for our group, our SIB Center, to grow. So I allotted a large portion of that endowment that I receive each year to hire a social worker. And that social worker is now a new person in the SIB Center that we did not even have before. And her entire job, and she's amazing, is to talk to long COVID patients who have no support at all, who have fallen through the cracks, who are becoming homeless, who have lost their job, who can't pay their electricity bill and therefore lose electricity and don't have internet or the ability to apply for disability. And we at the SIB Center try and help them apply for disability, to find new jobs, to prevent them living as a homeless person, and do whatever we can. And many of those people that we've helped have told us that they would have killed themselves, that they would have committed suicide. And I don't think that I did that, but I think all together as the community, we are hoping to help people pick up the pieces of their life. And the last thing I'll say is that my operative definition of mercy is to dive, my willingness to dive into the chaos of another person's life and provide lifting and healing. And so what we're trying to do at the SIP Center is be merciful to people who are suffering and don't have another way out. And so to do that, we need to both dive into their chaos, but also provide a way of lifting and healing them. And one more example, I won't mention this person's name because I haven't asked his permission. I always, by the way, get signed written permission and make sure that anybody's stories we share, that they want their story shared. So we're very, very respectful of people's privacy. I got an email this morning from a person who said that he was going through neuro hell with long COVID. That's exactly the words he used. And I called him back and he got very emotional to receive that call. He said, I just cannot believe that the SIP Center is contacting me. I've not found anybody yet. I think people are just grappling. They don't know where to go. And then he said, can I be part of your research? Can I be a candidate for a clinical trial? Can I join the support groups? Can I be part of this community? Because I feel all alone. I feel sad. I'm lonely. I'm desperate. And so that's what we try to do, is provide that personal connection, whether it be through emails, phone calls, the clinic, the support groups, however it may be. And the support groups are all free and we don't charge anything for those social services either.
How big a problem do you think long COVID is? And it's a two-part question, really. How big a problem do you think long COVID is in the US? And then the second part of that question is, why is there not more government support for these people? Why is there not a recognition of this growing community?
I think that the problem is, I think I would word this as a massive public health problem, crisis, that most of the world is yawning through and sleepwalking through. I think people are sleepwalking through this because it's too invisible if you're not suffering it. The people look like themselves. In fact, many of them say, my wife says that I'm making this up. My husband says that I should quit being such a baby or something. People, even in their own close personal circles, are being gaslit, if that's the right word, by those around them. And you know, I'm not pointing a finger and judging those people who don't believe it. It's very hard to understand it because you look so normal. But personally, I have a daughter who has suffered through traumatic brain injury. And she looks fine, but she suffered a great deal. And to people around her, they don't get it, why she has difficulty organizing herself and being late or not being able to do things that they expected. And as a father, I also didn't understand it. And I'm, you know, so close to her. I love her so much. So I see why people miss it, but I'm sure that makes it even the harder for the person suffering and being invisible to those around them.
What sort of figures are we talking?
I think that its conservative estimates would be 10 to 15 million Americans and 65 million worldwide. I do think those are conservative numbers. The reason I'm willing to go with those numbers is that I think it makes people take this more seriously if we're talking about the numbers of people who are actually, you know, experiencing disability from it and not those who are experiencing more mild symptoms. If you look at a study that just came out, in fact, I've got it right here from the British Medical Journal. This is a study published by Balouz, B-A-L-L-O-U-Z, that just came out in the BMJ. It's of 1,100 people. And these are people who were compared to controls from Zurich, Switzerland, and they have a graph in this manuscript which shows symptoms graded by mild, moderate, and then severe and very severe. And it is shocking the number of people who are severe and very severe. I'm just going to hold this up so you can see this. The pink bars are the very severe. Okay. Look at all that pink. It's crazy. And these are symptoms of severe vertigo, dizziness, neurological tremors, concentration difficulties, and memory issues. This is a very big deal. So if you just ignore the mild and only take those who are moderate, severe and very severe, we've got people in society who cannot operate their previous way of living. They can't go back to their jobs. They can't manage their families. They can't earn a living. And many of them are 30 and 40 years old.
You mentioned a paper the other day from Sweden, I think, that suggested that 85% of patients are still living with disabling symptoms 2 years after diagnosis. 85% of people. We have media here. The Guardian, a piece last week, said the majority of long COVID sufferers are recovering. So what we need is we need your voice. We're very, very appreciative of voices like yours that actually are giving some of those studies that are quite alarming a voice in a more public arena.
Yeah, and you know, in medicine, the most important thing that we as scientists can hang our hat on is consistency of message. And the study that you just mentioned that I was quoting earlier from Sweden is a different study, yet another study, not the one I was just talking about. That one that I just presented to you was from Switzerland. So when we see consistency of message from Switzerland to Sweden to the United States, now we start saying, okay, across methodologies, across patient populations and amongst different cohorts, we're seeing the same thing over and over again. Another example would be that a study just came out from the Recover Network from the NIH, 33 states of the United States, that showed that if you took people who had acute COVID, PCR positive, and they didn't know they would get long COVID, and you follow them over time in a very, very structured manner, that 1 in 10 ended up with significant long COVID symptoms. Well, if you go back 2 years before that, in The Lancet from the Netherlands, there was a huge study of 75,000 people that showed 12%. So here you've got the Netherlands and the US both tracking people prospectively over time and ending up within 2% of one another, 10 and 12%. This is not accidental, and this is reproducible, and this is consistency of message. So I think it's a very reliable number that 1 in 10 are going to have long COVID symptoms, that many of them have severe and very severe symptoms that stop them from going back to work. And actually, in the Swedish study, of those who had long COVID at 4 months and were unable to work because they were had disability, at 2 years, over half of those patients still could not go back to work.
The pandemic has not gone away as such. COVID hasn't gone away. Are you seeing increasing amounts of people coming through your doors, or is the number starting to tail off? Because some say that some of the strains after Omicron are not causing as much long COVID.
We have plenty of people still coming through the doors. Some of those people are first, second waivers who are just now realizing the extent of their disability and had thought it was going to get better and don't. But there are also people from the most recent waves post-Omicron who have this problem. And in the Recover Network, there were absolutely people from Omicron who have long COVID. There's no doubt at all that Omicron creates long COVID. And here's my last statement about in answer to your question. Even if the more recent strains create half as much long COVID, even if it's a quarter of the amount of long COVID, which I think it's more than that, that is still, if you play that out over across the world, that is still millions and millions of people. And that's what a public health crisis is.
Yeah. And as obviously someone who seems to read a huge number of papers, you must have also read Ziad Al-Ali's study suggesting that every reinfection, you're more likely to get long COVID. Does that also fit with what you're seeing, that some of these people are a second time round, maybe they were okay, but the third infection, that's brought on the long COVID?
Yes, and I might tell you that anecdotally, that's what I'm seeing, but your listeners should say, well, Dr. Ely, we don't care about your anecdote. We want to know the data. And what I would say is that the data, absolutely, Dr. Al-Ali's paper is not alone. Many other investigators have seen the exact same thing, including the recent Recover trial, which was of almost 10,000 patients. And they saw two things. Those who were unvaccinated had more long COVID, but even those who were vaccinated got long COVID. And the people who had multiple infections had a doubling of risk of long COVID.
My son said to me a couple of days ago, but people don't actually die of long COVID. And I just wondered, what do you think of that as a statement? Because it's almost like we've separated out all of these conditions that are a result of acute COVID, the heart attacks, the diabetes, the dementia, and the long COVID. It's almost like we've separated them out. So if you don't have that long chronic illness, it's not the same. But would you say that people are actually having these quite acute, sudden episodes as a result of long COVID.
I want to read something to you, and then I answer you. Your son's statement is spot on, and I want us to focus on that for just a second here. This is a person who had PICS, post-exposure care syndrome, and I want you to listen to this one paragraph and then think about long COVID. So this is a person after the ICU, but this is exactly the same thing experienced by patients who have long COVID. And your son's statement that they don't die from it is addressed here. Auden Huslid found his way to our support group after reading about delirium in a magazine. Before that, he had spent 4 years looking for answers, trying to understand what had happened to him after his illness. He told me, "I wish my right hand were cut off so that people would know immediately that there's something wrong with me. Instead, they look at me funny and wonder what my problem is." Auden was an investment banker on Wall Street, but hasn't worked since his hospital discharge. He says he doesn't know who he is anymore. Quote, "The wheel I need to move forward is the wheel that's actually missing." And this is what our long COVID patients are experiencing. They didn't die. And some of them say that they wished that they had died because nobody around them is acknowledging that they're ill. They can't live the way they want to live. And nobody will either validate or acknowledge that they have a problem. Worse, they feel gaslit and people are saying, "You're making this up." And then thirdly, that they can't find the wheel that they need to start going down the road because the wheel is actually gone. So they lose their own identity. And this is what's to me so sad is that this is about human dignity. And to me, the definition of humanism is saying every human, just because you're a person, is of priceless value. And that no amount of disease reduces your value or your worth, so that we each have a hold on one another. The hold we have on one another is that each of us must reach out and show the other person their dignity and lift them up and try to understand what it is that the other person's going through. And the long COVID patients are being dissed in that regard. And that's what's so sad and why the SIB Center is doing what we can to try and lift them up.
That's quite profound. Are you seeing people in the SIB Center over time getting worse, or are they stabilizing at a kind of a baseline?
What we see is about a third of people get better, a third get worse, and a third stay the same. Now, the third that stay the same are not satisfied by staying the same. They're very upset about staying the same. The third who are getting worse oftentimes do end up having suicidal ideations and don't see a way forward. And we know that this has happened because this has been in the media about people, you know, attempting to take their own life or successfully doing so. And this is exactly the same breakdown we get for post-intensive care syndrome, by the way. I'm so thankful that some people get better. And we love hearing their stories and we love learning what they did to get better. You know, some people are telling me it was metabolic, it was vitamin deficiencies, it was the need for more rest. And depending on someone's lifestyle, these things are very complicated. Like, for example, let's say that you were an endurance athlete. One of the people that I featured in a Boston Globe piece was named Alex Schell. We have permission to use his name. He was an endurance athlete who was training for the Olympics. He was running 4-minute miles and about 80 miles a week, and he completely lost his identity after getting long COVID. He had to completely quit running. He'll never be an Olympic athlete now. He said, "I don't know who I am anymore at all." And it makes him cry and fearful of his future. So this is the reality that people are living through, which I think is why your podcast is so important.
Do you see any pattern in the people that are doing better, getting better? Do you see any pattern in their treatment strategy or in the way that you have treated them to help improve?
I do. The most consistent pattern, and I don't know that this is for everyone, but this issue of post-exertional malaise is so profound that the people who are taking the amount they think they need to rest and doubling it tend to have a lot of success. And that's been a consistent message that I've heard from them, is that I think I need X amount of rest, I double that. Or another way of looking at it, which they have taught me, is here's how much I think I can do today. I'm going to cut that in half. And that's a really smart mechanism by which to not fall into the PEM. I'm going to cut in half what I think I can do today. And that way I don't overdo it. Because when I do overdo it, I end up being out for days and weeks.
I think Noreen and I suffer massively from that because as mothers, a lot of the time, mothers who are on our own looking after the children, it's incredibly difficult to prevent that overexertion. Even if you don't necessarily consider that you have direct PEM, that ability to pace is incredibly hard.
I was actually just going to ask physically, what do we think is happening to the body? Is the rest giving the body a chance to recover?
Yeah, what I think is happening to the body is that the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2 virus, has attacked initially the respiratory epithelium, but then invades the endothelium, the lining of the blood vessels. And when the lining of the blood vessels is invaded, we have a problem with activation of clotting, coagulation cascade, and ultimately we end up getting disease of the mitochondria. And the mitochondrial disease, which is where in our body we have oxidative phosphorylation, which is essentially another way of saying that is how do we use our oxygen, then our body, the tissues, the muscles and the body tissues become unable to use that oxygenation. And so what happens is we go into anaerobic metabolism, lactic acidosis gets created, pain and suffering. So essentially, if the mitochondria have become, and I'll make up a word here, geriatricized, they are geriatric mitochondria, and they operate at an extremely slow pace. They have no good recovery, that when the person goes past a certain point, then the body goes into deficit. And that's why the PEM is so severe. And it's not just exertional PEM, it's also thought PEM, so cognitive disturbance. And there's that physical, but there's also that cognitive PEM.
I often think that my PEM is much more pronounced from cognitive exertion than from physical exertion. But exactly. I don't understand the science behind that.
So we believe that some avenues here, three avenues I'll just mention. One would be more antiviral to knock the virus out more. That there are at least four studies in the US alone of Paxlovid, and I'll be participating in one of those double-blind placebo-controlled trials of Paxlovid. The other avenue is anti-inflammation. And the grant that I showed you is an immunomodulator. So not immunosuppression, but modulating the immune system to turn off the light switch that was turned on. That's what we're hoping to go to next.
Is that an oral treatment or is that some more invasive?
Yeah, oral treatment.
Okay.
Oral. And then also the clotting cascade, which I mentioned earlier. And there's a lot of people interested in investigating the clotting cascade. So these are just three examples, but there are numerous other venues by which people are going to be pursuing this in the next couple of years. Science is not in the habit of moving this fast. In fact, it's actually moved way faster. The vaccine story was, you know, unprecedented. And by the way, for all of our vaccine sufferers who are listening, I firmly acknowledge that vaccine injury is real, and it looks a lot like long COVID. These patients who experience vaccine injury, I'm so very sorry for your suffering. The reality from a public health perspective, of course, is that those people who experience that are dwarfed by the number of people who have long COVID from the virus itself, but it doesn't make it any less real to somebody who got the vaccine injury. And so what we have to do is acknowledge both and provide services for both camps of people. And the government has to do a better job of helping these people find their new normal funding clinics, funding disability services, and giving them unemployment, for example, when they can't go back to work.
One question I haven't asked anyone else yet, and believe me, we've asked a lot of questions to a lot of people, is that if you get long COVID from COVID, SARS-CoV-2, and if you can also replicate that long COVID by having a vaccine, if you're unlucky enough, doesn't that give a clue as to what's driving long COVID?
The spike protein, maybe, or
it gives a clue, but it's not the whole story. Because if the vaccine is related to spike protein, and you can say to yourself, the vast majority of people who get a spike protein injected into their arm have enough of an appropriate immune response that when they get the virus, they won't get ill. That's the majority of what occurs. But there are some people, a very small number of people, but an important minority of people who get that spike protein. And instead of having that appropriate immune response, which protects them, they get an overexuberant immune response that chronically causes them POTS, brain dysfunction, PEM, autonomic dysfunction, which is essentially what long COVID is. Okay. But there are other parts of the virus that a first waiver, a second waiver, and now even an Omicron person who's gotten the vaccine but didn't have a problem with the vaccine, that they then get long COVID after the next reinfection, that long COVID can be created by. So if it were as simple as it's all spike protein, then that would be great, but it's not. And there are some great scientists out there working this out who are very convinced that there are other components of the virus itself that are probably more long COVID inducing than the spike.
Absolutely fascinating. But I'm aware that you have to go. I just want to thank you for your advocacy for us as long COVID sufferers. I don't actually know where you find the time to read all of the studies or to write all of the papers and your grant submissions and your articles, but having your voice out there in the mainstream media makes a huge, huge difference to long COVID sufferers. So we are very, very appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just close by saying two things. One is that I really feel privileged to be a widget in this process. I'm a small piece of this situation, but we are glad to be of service. And I'm surrounded by so many smart people, much smarter than I am, who help us get this work done. So I'm just one person of a big team. And then the last thing is that what we have to realize, a Spanish phrase, cada persona es un mundo. Each person is a world. And if we can just look in each other's eyes and say, you are a world, you are an entity that is so priceless, and we want you to know how valuable you are, and your long COVID doesn't reduce your value, never give up hope. We are all going to work this out together. We're going to do our part and find medical solutions, but also build community. Because ultimately, community will help us get through when we're suffering. And what I say to the long COVID patients is this: I don't have the answers, but I won't leave you. We'll stay with you, we'll stay at your side, and we'll get through this together. I'm not trying to pretend I understand your suffering, but please continue to tell me what you're going through, and we'll do our best.
Dr. Ely, as he describes in the interview, is really, really trying to advocate for patients. He's really trying to push the agenda with the amount of media that he's doing, the amount of studies, the amount of grants, and the number of patients that he's trying to reach.
Yeah, and you need voices like that, loud voices and sensible voices, to counter the other narrative that runs through long COVID, which is that it doesn't exist. And that we do just need to get on our exercise bikes and, like me, fall off it. I do want to say, though, we live in our own bubble doing this podcast, where we talk to people who believe the science and believe that there is a mechanism driving our illness. And I've just come off reading, because I read a lot, obviously, and as you do, and we're on social media quite a lot, because a lot of where you find more researchers lives on that space. And I was just reading about a person who went to a cardiologist and who was told, quote, "I've been told long COVID doesn't exist, so you should just go and get some exercise, you're deconditioned." And that really still shocks me.
It is shocking, isn't it? This far in, this much research, this number, this size of a patient cohort, it is shocking that people in the medical profession are still choosing to not believe the science. Surely it goes against the ethical code of being a doctor.
It begs the question, why? Why do they not want to believe it? Maybe because they can't help us?
Because it's too big a problem to actually face?
Yeah.
Yeah. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.